Oh, that sounded so good to me. I needed some comfort. Because of pressing business, I was unable to be here until now. Okay, now let's see. To orient myself where I am. This is Prophecies of the Last Days class, and we're studying the 2300 days of Daniel. I guess I need someone to tell me where I left off, and then we'll start there and go on. We were reading file 18. Okay.
You were just about to give us, I think, the name of the worst region, the loose-lipped ruler.
Right. He's Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes. Let's see. We must have been reading... Were we just barely started to read this file? Is that where we were? Okay, let's read the file. Everybody have a copy of file 18? Okay. Daniel 8 is a prophecy of Persia and... It's a prophecy of Medo-Persia and then Greece, and how Greece overthrew Medo-Persia. Then Alexander was the notable horn on the he-goat, and that was broken. Four came up in its place, and those are the four generals who reigned in his place, and then out of one of them came a little horn. So this history pertains to this. The Seleucid dynasty lasted from 312 to 64 B.C., and was comprised of 22 Greek rulers of Syria and Mesopotamia. So let's put that down as a definition of the Seleucids. The Seleucids are Greek kings of Syria and Mesopotamia. Syria is, of course, this area north of Palestine. All of this is Syria. Damascus is the capital of Syria. It was in Bible days and it still is today. Damascus is the oldest inhabited city in the world today. Mesopotamia refers to the land between the Tigris and the Euphrates River. Here's the Tigris, here's the Euphrates, and it means this fertile area between the two rivers. In fact, that's what the word itself means. Mesos means in the middle in Greek. And then Potamia, or Pot, see, I'm not sure the exact form of the word here. Pot, let's see, I wrote this wrong. Potamia means river. And so it means in the middle of the rivers. In fact, that's what a hippopotamus is. Hippopotamus. Hippo means horse. And so a hippopotamus means a river horse in Greek. Okay. So Mesopotamia means it's farther east now of Palestine in the Middle East. Okay. And was comprised of 22 Greek rulers of Syria and Mesopotamia. It was founded by a general of Alexander the Great named Seleucus I, Nicator. Seleucus was the son of Antiochus, one of the generals of Philip of Macedonia, who was Alexander's father. With the help of Ptolemy I, Soter, who was another of Alexander's generals, Seleucus established himself as ruler in Mesopotamia in 312 B.C., thus, this date is generally recognized as marking the establishment of the Seleucid monarchy. We're going to work with the 312 date this evening, so remember that. In other words, we would say Alexander the Great died in 337, and then Seleucus didn't begin his reign officially till 312 B.C. On a timeline, as you're heading toward Christ, you're getting smaller, you know. So Alexander died in 327. Seleucus begins his reign in 312. The four generals did not reign instantly. It took a while through power struggles and so forth. Okay. It says, with the help of Ptolemy, Seleucus established himself as ruler in 312, so this date is generally recognized. During much of the history of the dynasty, the Seleucids, Greek kings of Syria and Mesopotamia, fought against the Ptolemies, Greek kings of Egypt, in wars to determine territorial sovereignty. Did we talk about this chart here that has the horns? Okay, and so I said originally, what was it? Lysimachus in the north. Originally, you'd say the north horn was Lysimachus, but in the end of the prophecy, Seleucus becomes the north horn, and the Ptolemies become the south horn. We're only going to deal with those two. We're going to ignore the other ones. So it says the Seleucids, remember now these are all Greek men. They're Greeks, but they're ruling over other nations besides Greece. So the Ptolemies are Greek kings of Egypt in wars to determine territorial sovereignty. The division of the Bible lands between these two great powers in the intertestamental period accounts for the titles King of the North and King of the South in Daniel 11. The northern half belonging to Seleucus and his successors, and the southern half to the Ptolemies. Only a little more than 100 years after its founding, the Seleucid dynasty lost much land to the Romans about 190, during the reign of Antiochus III. Judas Maccabeus led a revolt against the Seleucid ruler Antiochus IV Epiphanes from 167 until his death in 160. By 129, the Seleucid had lost control of Mesopotamia, and their power had declined in Syria. The end of the dynasty came in 64 BC when the Roman general Pompey made Syria a Roman province, and the last Seleucid ruler, Antiochus XIII Asiaticus, was murdered a short time afterward. Following is a list of all the rulers during the Seleucid dynasty, 312 to 64 BC. Although there were only 22 Seleucid kings, during the period of the dynasty there were three non-Seleucid rulers, and one of the Seleucid rulers reigned at two distinct times. These four additional reigns are marked with an asterisk, and they account for the total of 26 reigns during the dynasty. So you'll find those at number 11, Alexander Belus, Theopater Eugertes, a usurper who pretended to be a son of Epiphanes, but he really wasn't. Antiochus VI, Theos, Epiphanes, Dionysus. Now you see those words, Theos. What's Theos mean? God. What does Epiphany mean? Do you remember the word? Epiphania at the rapture? Everybody forgot. It means brightness. And so you would translate it with regard to a person, the illustrious one or the bright shining one. And so it means this. This guy, Antiochus VI, called himself the illustrious god Dionysus. That was his name, according to him. Son of Alexander Belus and reigned as a minor. So they claimed to be part of the true dynasty of Seleucid kings, but they weren't even of their family. They were fakes. Okay, then number 15, Demetrius, his second reign. This guy is a real member of the family. And then finally, 25, Tigranes, king of Armenia, invited to the throne by the Syrians over all the rival claimants and held it until overthrown by the Roman general Lucullus. So Demetrius is a real Seleucid, number 15. He reigned twice. You'll notice he reigned up there earlier in number 13. So then lastly, you have this chart on page 3. This is designed to show who is son of whom. Okay, because a dynasty means a series of kings of one family. And so father to son to father to son to father to son. So you can see Antiochus is the son of Seleucus. Antiochus II is the son of Antiochus. Seleucus II is the son of Antiochus II. And then Seleucus had two kings, both of whom reigned. Two sons, I mean, both of whom reigned. Seleucus III and Antiochus III. Now, the worst ruler of all these is Antiochus IV. So we'll go back to him on this handout on the first page. He's the eighth Seleucid ruler, Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, also son of Magnus, and thus brother of Philopater. So he is the worst of the Seleucid rulers, number 8. Those are his dates of reign, 176 to 164. And we set up here in the paragraph that he persecuted the Jews from 167, excuse me, he persecuted the Jews from maybe 175 to 164. There's about 11 years of persecution against the Jews, but he was opposed by the Jews by Judas Maccabeus. Judas Maccabeus is a Jewish patriot, and his story is told in the apocryphal books. You've heard of the Apocrypha, those Catholic books that they add to the middle of the Catholic Bible. And there's 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Maccabees. The Maccabee name is a family name of a group of Jews who were Jewish patriots, and they fought against these Syrian kings. Okay, let's see if there's anything else I want to say. I guess I covered all the history right up to where we are. Other than just to say that Antiochus Epiphanes, who ruled 175 to 164, was violently bitter against the Jews. And he made a furious, determined effort to exterminate the Jews and their religion. He's the 8th in their dynasty. He devastated Jerusalem about 168 BC. He defiled the temple. He offered a pig on the holy altar in the temple. He erected an altar to Jupiter over the top of God's sacrifice altar, so the true altar was covered. He prohibited Jews coming into the temple to worship. He forbade mothers to circumcise their sons on pain of death. He destroyed every copy of the scripture that could be found. He slaughtered anybody who had in possession of such a copy of the Bible. He sold thousands of Jewish families into slavery. He slew 40,000 Jews at one time. He resorted to every conceivable torture to force Jews to eat pork and renounce their religion. And all of these things happened in the intertestamental period. When we're looking in history now, we're talking somewhere between 175 BC and 164 BC. The height of the persecution is right down here in the last few years before 164. It's something like 167 to 164 BC. And believe it or not, it lasts for about 3.5 years. And so it's a type of course, the persecution under the Antichrist depicted in the book of Revelation, or predicted in the book of Revelation. You know, the 3.5 years of persecution against the church. This man is a type of the Antichrist. It's very clear typology here. Antiochus Epiphanes. You'll notice he has the word Epiphany in his name. And so Epiphanes means illustrious. And so it means the bright and shining one, Antiochus, or Antiochus the illustrious. The Jews instead called him Epimenes. E-P-I-M-A-N-E-S. And Epimenes means madman in Hebrew. And so they made this little play on words, and the Jews thought that was funny. They could call him Epimenes instead of Epiphanes. It's a pun on his name due to his wild, savage, and violent nature. The person who is an expert punster, if you don't know that, is Greg Thiel. Did you know that? He really is an expert at making a pun. I'm sure if he wanted to, he could make probably 10 puns on every one-hour sermon. And I'm not exaggerating. He's that good at it. It's incredible how good at it he is. I'm not a good punster. Anybody here? Punster is a word. It means one who makes puns. It is. It's a true word in English. Okay, now what I want to do today is read to you from the Catholic Bible, from the Apocrypha. And this is the only class in Bible college where we're going to read from the Apocrypha, okay? So, now I'm really going to get in trouble with the pastor. No, I'm just kidding. Reading from the Apocrypha. Okay, we're going to read 1 Maccabees, chapters 1 and 2, and 2 Maccabees, chapters 5 through 7. I have studied the Apocrypha some, not very much. And I have learned that in the opinion of most of the top evangelicals and Pentecostal theologians who write systematic theology books, there are only two good books in the whole Apocrypha, and they are 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees. 1 Maccabees is better than 2 Maccabees. Excuse me, they are only to be relied upon for historical material. They are definitely not inspired. You'll pick up little hints along the way as I'm reading, I'm sure, where you'll witness in your spirit or you'll have an intellectual bump when I read a few little statements. You'll see what I mean. Okay, this story is all about Antiochus Epiphanes and how badly he persecuted the Jews, because the Maccabee family, and that's spelled M-A-C-C-A, and then one B, and then two E's, the Maccabee family. They resisted Antiochus. So here's the story. First Maccabees, chapters 1 and 2. After Alexander the Macedonian, Philip's son, who came from the land of Kittim, had defeated Darius, king of the Persians and Medes, he became king in his place, having first ruled in Greece. He fought many campaigns, captured fortresses, and put kings to death. He advanced to the ends of the earth, gathering plunder from many nations. The earth fell silent before him, and his heart became proud and arrogant. He collected a very strong army and conquered provinces, nations, and rulers, and they became his tributaries. But after all this, he took to his bed, realizing that he was going to die. He therefore summoned his officers, the nobles, who had been brought up with him from his youth, to divide his kingdom among them while still alive. Alexander had reigned 12 years when he died. So his officers took over his kingdom, each in his own territory, and after his death, they all put on royal crowns, and so did their sons after them for many years, causing much distress over the earth. So he's saying there were dynasties from all four. There sprang from these a sinful offshoot, Antiochus Epiphanes, son of King Antiochus. Now you'll notice this book is stealing the terminology of the Bible. Because in the Bible it says, four horns came up, and out of one of them came forth the little horn. And so this calls it a sinful offshoot. So it uses the same illustration of having, you know, a branch of a tree or a horn or some other item, and then out of that comes a little shoot out of it. He says, Antiochus Epiphanes, son of King Antiochus, once a hostage at Rome. He became king in the year 137 of the kingdom of the Greeks. Now that's because they start the dynasty at 312. And so it means 137 years into the dynasty that started at 312. So watch. You get 0, carry the 1, 7 from 12 is 5. Reduce that to 2, carry the 1, 3 from 10 is 7, and you get 175 B.C. That's when Antiochus began his reign. It's called the year 137. Now, all the years are going to be dated on that method in this book. In those days, there appeared in Israel men who were breakers of the law. Now, here's what I want you to do. Draw parallels in your mind between what you think will happen to Christians under the Antichrist with how the Jews reacted toward this persecutor who is a type of the Antichrist. If you do that, you'll see a number of parallels between things that happened then and things that most probably will happen up in the future. I think I can see lots of parallels, like this one, for example. In those days, there appeared in Israel men who were breakers of the law, and they seduced many people, saying, "Let us go and make an alliance with the Gentiles all around us. Since we separated from them, many evils have come upon us." The proposal was agreeable, some from among the people promptly went to the king, and he authorized them to introduce the way of living of the Gentiles. Boy, can't you see that happening in the time of a one-world government? They said, since we remain separated from this wonderful world government that's all, unified and everything, we've had all kinds of trouble. We need to join ourselves with the system. That's what Christians will do, for sure. The proposal was agreeable. Thereupon, they built a gymnasium in Jerusalem, according to the Gentile custom. Now, you and I would not have a problem with that, you know, building a gymnasium in our city. But see, to the Jews, that was an abomination, because they regarded that to be worldliness and against the worship of Yahweh, the one true God. They covered over the mark of their circumcision. Now, see, that would be wrong to do. And they abandoned the Holy Covenant. They allied themselves with the Gentiles and sold themselves to wrongdoing. This means they intentionally went against what God's word said. They knew plainly the word commanded circumcision. But because of all the trouble and the persecution, instead of standing firm for God, they broke down and they gave in and they went against what they knew to be true from the word. They allied themselves with Gentiles and sold themselves to wrongdoing. When his kingdom seemed secure, Antiochus proposed to become king of Egypt so as to rule over both kingdoms. Now, I told you in File 18 that the Seleucids up here in Mesopotamia often fought wars with the Ptolemies in Egypt for territorial sovereignty. This is going to describe that a little bit. He invaded Egypt with a strong force, with chariots and elephants, and with a large fleet to make war on Ptolemy, king of Egypt. Ptolemy was frightened at his presence and fled, leaving many casualties. The fortified cities in the land of Egypt were captured, and Antiochus plundered the land of Egypt. After Antiochus had defeated Egypt in the year 143, see, let's have somebody figure that one out. What's 312 minus 143? So we could say, began his reign in 175. Okay, then 169 would be he conquered Egypt. These are events for Antiochus Epiphanes. After he defeated Egypt in 169, he returned and went up to Israel and to Jerusalem with a strong force. Now he's going to enter Jerusalem. He insolently invaded the sanctuary and took away the golden altar, the lampstand for the light with all its fixtures. That's the incense altar. Now, remember the shape of the temple? It looked like this. It's a rectangle with a square at the upper end. And in here you have the Ark of the Covenant, although they didn't have it anymore at this time because it was destroyed in the Babylonian captivity. And so they had an altar of incense, they had a table of showbread, and they had a lampstand. You know, this type of a lampstand right here. So it means they took away the golden altar, that's the incense altar, and the lampstand for the light with all its fixtures, the offering table, that's this, the table of showbread, the cups and the bowls, the golden censers, the curtain, that's the veil of the temple, the crowns, the golden ornament on the facade of the temple. He stripped off everything and took away the gold and silver and precious vessels. He also took all the hidden treasures he could find. Taking all this, he went back to his own country after he had spoken with great arrogance and shed much blood. So in 169, Antiochus with his army came down, conquered Egypt, and on his way back to Syria, he conquered Palestine and specifically Jerusalem, and he even entered the temple and plundered and stole the temple gold. And there's a little poem here now in the Catholic Bible. And there was great mourning for Israel in every place where they dwelt. And the rulers and the elders groaned. Virgins and young men languished, and the beauty of the women was disfigured. Every bridegroom took up lamentation. She who sat in the bridal chamber mourned, and the land was shaken on account of its inhabitants, and all the house of Jacob was covered with shame. 2 years later,
so let's write that down,
167, the king sent the Mizian commander to the cities of Judah, and he came to Jerusalem with a strong force.
So now we have armies entering Jerusalem. 167,
these are Greek armies from Syria entering Jerusalem. He spoke to them deceitfully in peaceful terms. Now this is not Antiochus himself, but he's sending a commander of his army into the city. So the commander spoke deceitfully in peaceful terms and won their trust. Then he attacked the city suddenly in a great onslaught and destroyed many of the people in Israel. He plundered the city and set fire to it, demolished its houses and its surrounding walls, took captive the women and children, and seized the cattle. Then they built up the city of David with a high, massive wall and strong towers, and it became their citadel. Now, what he's saying is this. Jerusalem is a big city. And just for this, this is not accurate at all, but just for the sake of drawing, I'll show you what they're doing. Assume this is all of Jerusalem. Well, in the higher upper part of the city, which is elevated, they conquered this part of the city called the City of David, and it means the ancient, older part of Jerusalem. And they built a wall around this area, and it was like a walled city within a city, and it's called the Citadel. The Citadel. It refers to a part of the city of Jerusalem that was walled in, and it had a great big tower in it, and they put all of their Greek-Syrian army troops in that who were occupying the city of Jerusalem. So it's saying they built up this citadel. There they installed a sinful race, perverse men, who fortified themselves inside it, storing up weapons and provisions and depositing there the plunder they had collected from Jerusalem. And they became a great threat. Now, here's another poem. It says, the citadel became an ambush against the sanctuary and a wicked adversary to Israel at all times. And they shed innocent blood around the sanctuary. They defiled the sanctuary. Because of them, the inhabitants of Jerusalem fled away, and she became the abode of strangers. She became a stranger to her own offspring, and her children forsook her. Her sanctuary was as desolate as a wilderness. Her feasts were turned into mourning, her Sabbath to shame, her honor to contempt. Her dishonor was as great as her glory had been, and her exaltation was turned into mourning. This is all in 167 now, and the armies enter Jerusalem. Then the king wrote to his whole kingdom. Now, draw parallels to the Antichrist. That all should be one people, each abandoning his particular customs. Anybody see any parallels there? What do you see? Can't you see how they would do that in the end time? They say, everybody in the whole world is supposed to all be one people now. And you Americans give up your American customs, and you Africans give up your African customs. And we're all going to live in a new age where we all agree and practice all the same things. All the Gentiles conform to the command of the king. Boy, I expect that. That means the unsaved. Because you have the Jews, they're God's elect, and they're saved. And then you have all the Gentiles, and basically they're unsaved. The unsaved masses of the world will conform to the Antichrist system. When they want to do something, they just go along with it. But God's people don't. There's resistance there. It says, and many Israelites were in favor of his religion. They sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. Sad, huh? Some of the Christians, we would draw an analogy here. They'll give in to the thing. They'll worship the Antichrist, follow the false prophet, believe his doctrines, and worship in their religious practice, which is a shame. The king sent messengers with letters to Jerusalem and to the cities of Judah, ordering them to follow customs foreign to their land. Boy, how would you like that? The Antichrist sends messengers with letters, so you get a letter signed, the Antichrist, you know. And the messenger comes right to your city. And his job is to make you conform to their customs. Yikes. Persecution is going to be on, huh? For sure. And to prohibit holocausts, those are burnt offerings, sacrifices and libations in the sanctuary, so you can't offer sacrifices anymore of any kind, not even liquid ones. To profane the Sabbath and feast days, so that means they're going to make you work on Saturday, and when the holy feast day comes, you can't keep it. They won't let you. If you do, they'll kill you. To desecrate the sanctuary and the sacred ministers, which means they'll come right into the temple of God, right into Christian churches, we would say, and desecrate them, swear, yell, scream, defile, break them up with axes, burn some to the ground, write curse words all over them, commit fornication right in the sanctuary, take drugs, turn it into something else other than a church. This is sickening, but that's what they're doing. And it says, and the sacred ministers. So they'll spit on them and lie against them and throw them in jail and fire them and, you know, rake their reputation over the coals. To build pagan altars and temples and shrines. So they're forcing Jews to build pagan altars. And we would say, in our analogy, at gunpoint. Is that really what you want your labor to be from 9 in the morning till 5, building pagan buildings for them to worship in? And then it says, to sacrifice swine and unclean animals. So at sword point, they force Jews to offer pigs on their sacrifice altars and unclean animals, to leave their sons uncircumcised. Now that was a command of the Bible. Circumcise your son on the eighth day, according to the book of Exodus. And to let themselves be defiled with every kind of impurity and abomination. So again, they were forced into immoral, impure acts. Now again, I say, nobody really could force you to do that. You know, as far as sexual acts go or something, you, with that in particular, you couldn't really be forced to do that. I suppose you could say maybe a woman could be forced, a man couldn't be forced, but you could refuse on pain of death to participate in any such thing. That's for sure. It's wickedness here. It says, so that they might forget the law and change all their observances. Whoever refused to act according to the command of the king should be put to death. Yikes. This is a serious thing. This happened in history, to where Antiochus sent a messenger into their city with a letter, and they were backed up with the militia to enforce the thing. No circumcision, work on the Sabbath, no feast days, offer pigs on the altar, eat pork, go against the Jewish laws, etc. The Jews are in trouble. Such were the orders he published throughout his kingdom. He appointed inspectors over all the people, and he ordered the cities of Judah to offer sacrifices, each city in turn. Ooh, that's even tougher now, isn't it? It means you go one by one. So they, you know, the army is going to arrive at your city, and you can imagine what would happen if you put this into modern terms. What this would mean is this. We live here in Burien. So assuming that communism takes over America or something like that, and I'm not predicting that, I'm just saying for the sake of argument, it would be like this. Then you have 4 army trucks of soldiers drive up into your neighborhood. And, you know, maybe there's 30 soldiers in each one with guns with bayonets on the end. And they all jump out with their uniforms on and they say, okay, now we're going one city at a time and if necessary from house to house. And we're going to force everybody to obey what we say. This is what is happening. This is a terrible persecution of these Jews. This is horrid. He appointed inspectors over all the people, and he ordered the cities of Judah to offer sacrifices. Now, you know what that means. That means one at a time, house to house, all four people in that home come out, and they say at bayonet point, you either offer this sacrifice now or we'll kill you. Many of the people, those who abandoned the law, joined them and committed evil in the land. Sad. Many of them, it said, did that. Instead of standing strong for Yahweh, they bowed the knee to Baal. They went ahead and offered the sacrifice. Then it says, Israel was driven into hiding wherever places of refuge could be found. Now, God has never forbidden His people to flee in the time of persecution. In fact, there are several places in the Bible that tell you to flee in times of persecution. You see the example of the apostles doing it, and you see the example of, you see Christ's warning to the Jews to flee when they see Jerusalem surrounded. And so I don't think fleeing during a time of persecution is wrong. Now, there is an exception to that, and that is when there's no way out. When there's no way out, then all Christians should just give in and go ahead and be martyred. But if there is a way out, you have a right, just by the way God has created you and the world, to flee. You really do. God gave you two legs, right? Is it lawful to use your legs or not? Of course it is. Oh, I said, is it lawful to use the legs God gave you? And the answer is yes. And obviously, He created more continents than just one, right? So as far as I'm concerned, if you can get to another continent, go. That's the way I look at it. If all the Christians are living free on another continent, the continent you're on is persecuting you, you don't have to live under that continent. Live on the other continent. Now, you might have to sneak and connive to get there, but if you do, you do. That's the way I look at it. Now, on the other hand, if you were living in a place where every Christian was being hunted down, there's absolutely no way out, well, at times like that, when all the Christians are going en masse, it's not going to do you any good to try to get away. The Christians are better at that point to just go ahead and participate and be martyred. And that's what happened in Rome. It got so bad that they stopped fleeing. It was impossible. So they just gave themselves up. And when they were taken into the amphitheater, they didn't even fight the animals. They just stood there and got torn to shreds. So at that time, it doesn't do any good to fight. In fact, if you did fight, you would be wrong at that time. Because then you could be put on trial for assault, or maybe even killing someone. And then you'd go on trial. You'd still hang, but now you'd hang as a murderer instead of as a Christian. So, see, you're better not to resist. Okay, we'll stop there.